Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. No guests today. It is just us. I think the last, like, three episodes of the show have been over an hour long, so we're giving everybody a little break.
Yeah, probably a good thing because a lot happened in the last week.
Jasmine, a special session has come and gone since the last time we talked, so... Yeah, we're talking about that. Jasmine's going to talk about a new U.S. Senate candidate who declared, I guess, like the day that we recorded.
That's how it always happens.
Yeah. And then lastly, we have information about a new caucus that is forming in the legislature, specifically in the House. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then we have some quick hits to get to, as always. So without any further ado, let's talk about the special session. Jasmine, it finally happened. The special session occurred. We have a new quasi's law. You know, I don't know. Would you say it's good or bad? Or I mean, what is it? It's kind of complicated, right? Because the quasi's needed relief, but this is maybe not relief, right?
Yeah, I would say bad.
I would say
overall.
I think you're right. I think overall it's bad. I think overall it's bad, but
a little complicated, but you're going to tell us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Governor Bevin issued a proclamation calling the legislature into special session on Thursday of last week. And as we expected, the proclamation itself was very narrow. The proclamation was 5 pages. So whenever you have a proclamation, there's usually like a bunch of like whereases that lay out exactly why we need a special session. Like, whereas the pension requirement rate has gone way up for quasis, and whereas we need these quasis to exist as a community, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the whereases. They lasted 2 pages, but 3 whole pages were dedicated to restricting the special session to only considering the bill that the governor favored. And really key in the midst of this proclamation is the sentence that's this, quote, "For the sole purpose of considering legislation to enact a non-severable comprehensive act to do the following," unquote. So there's more that it lays out there. But many people were very surprised that the proclamation specifically outlined the special session to consider a non-severable bill only.
What was surprising about that?
All right. So non-severability essentially means that if a court takes up a case about the bill, so if Andy Beshear sues, which he said he's likely to do, the judge cannot strike down just a portion of the law. So the whole thing has to come down. And that's interesting, because what would have happened likely is that the judge would have struck down the portion about the funding to say, like, some of this violates the inviolable contract. The way that you're changing benefits for these people, that violates the inviolable contract. But the rate freeze, which is another part of this bill, it can stay. Mm-hmm. So that would be if the bill was severable. But the proclamation that the governor issued said, no, legislature, you cannot consider a bill that could potentially be severable. That's kind of a big deal. That's a very restrictive call to say, not only can you only consider the bill that I am putting forward, you can't even make it severable. You can't even make that decision. I'm making the decision about what you can do.
Okay.
So, you know, this wasn't without recrimination. So many Republicans issued recriminations about a 2008 special session proclamation from Steve Beshear, which they said was, quote, much more restrictive, unquote, than Bevin's. But Jasmine, that's incorrect.
They were wrong?
Yes. At least in my opinion. Beshear's proclamation was just one paragraph. There were some whereases, but the section that was, you know, 3 pages in Bevin's proclamation was only one paragraph in Steve Beshear's proclamation back in 2008. And it called the special session, quote, "for the sole purpose of considering the pension reform principles embodied in Bill Request 2, unquote. So Bill Request 2 back in that time was about pensions, unbelievably. It was actually right after Steve Beshear was elected, where he was trying to do something about pensions in a special section. So this is actually quite a bit in the weeds, Jasmine, but that's okay. The manual that most legislative bodies use to dictate procedure is called Mason's Manual of Legislative Procedure. And section 780 of that manual deals with special sessions. And it actually explains the rules about how and when a governor can call special sessions and how proclamations can restrict that call. So section 780.6, this is a quote from it, quote, "In determining whether a given act is germane to the subject stated in the proclamation, the entire proclamation should be considered and should be reasonably construed to bring the act within its meaning, if possible," unquote. So Governor Beshear's proclamation restricted the legislature to Bill Request 2, as it says, but it also included the language, quote, "the reform principles embodied." So by including that language, he recognized that the legislature had the ability to do their job. So many bills are marked up, during the regular legislative session and still hew to the original bill request. So the legislature, they issue amendments, they're voted on in committee and on the floor, and the legislature themselves can say, okay, yeah, this is germane to the bill request, this is germane to the subject of the bill, and we're going to let this amendment go forward. But Matt Bevin's, you know, three-page bill request literally lays out the bill he favors and restricts the session to only considering this bill and does not even allow any changes to be made at all. So to say that Governor Beshear's 2008 proclamation is even more restrictive is just wrong, in my opinion, and that's why. Okay. So there you go. There's why that's wrong. But the legislature convened again on Friday. So this was 1 week ago. And all three bills were allowed to be filed. So HB1 was the governor's bill. HB2 is the Democratic BR11, which we covered last week, the Democratic plan. And then HB3 was a simple one-year rate freeze.
So who gets to decide that all of them are going to be heard, like given that Governor Bevin's proclamation was so restrictive?
Yeah, so I think that anybody can submit legislation at any time. Just by virtue of being in the legislature, you're allowed to file bills to be, you know, to sponsor a piece of legislation. And then it's up to the committee chairs to actually, you know, I guess the LRC, the Committee on Committees, which is just the leaders in the legislature, they assign those out to specific committees, and those committee chairs can make the decision as to whether or not to actually hear those bills. So all three of these bills got sent to the state government committee in the House. And actually, those Democratic bills did receive hearings in the legislature on Saturday the 20th in the state government committee in the House. And actually, the Democratic bills had lots and lots of people speak in favor, and that includes Jim Carroll, who's the president of the Kentucky Government Retirees, including Larry Totten, who's the president of Kentucky Public Retirees, which I guess is different, and leaders of several quasis, including the Hazard Health Department and the Kentucky Professional Firefighters. So when they were hearing things about the Democratic bills, there were several people testifying in favor. Representative James Tipton, who's the sponsor of HB1, was the main speaker for the governor's proposal, along with KRS Executive Director Dave Egger. And I think he was just at the table. I don't even think he spoke about it. I think that basically James Tipton, he might have been the only person who spoke in favor of HB1, whereas the Democratic plan had like a ton of people going up there and talking about how much they liked it.
And he was also the sole sponsor of it.
Yeah. Right?
So it's like one person versus
A whole bunch of people.
A lot of people.
a lot of people in the Democratic caucus sponsored what were HB2 and HB3. James Tipton was the only person to be a sponsor on HB1. So HB1 did pass out of committee, and HBs 2 and 3 were defeated, and it was almost entirely a party line vote. Tommy Turner, who's a Republican from Somerset, he was the only Republican who voted against HB1 in committee. Jim Duplessis from E-Town, he passed on the vote, so he didn't vote against it, he just didn't vote for it. And no Republicans voted for HBs 2 or 3 in committee. So they did receive a vote, though. Even though it's disappointing that the Democratic bills didn't get much GOP support, I think that Jerry Miller, the representative who's the chair of the state government committee, I think it's a credit to him that the bills were heard. They didn't have to do this, and in fact, it's been exceedingly rare for Democratic bills to get any kind of hearing in the legislature these days.
Right, that's something that we talked to a lot of our guests about, who got no bills heard in committee, and so I guess they gave us this one courtesy.
Yeah, and it's no doubt that it's incredibly disappointing that nobody came out to support these bills, which in my opinion were clearly better than HB1. I think that that's too bad. I do think it was good to have these bills heard in committee, though. That's at least one tiny, tiny silver lining. HB1 actually did make its way to the floor on Monday, July 21st. So Democrats attempted to offer four different amendments. Two of them would have like deleted HB1 entirely and replaced it with HB2 or 3, which is a nice, cool trick. I mean, you got to throw the kitchen sink at this, I guess. And the other two amendments just tried to strike the non-severability language from the bill, just to make it severable, so that when this does eventually end up in court, when they say that it violates the inviolable contract, they don't also say, and also that means the quasis go back to having to pay an insane amount of money. But all of the Democratic amendments were ruled out of order based on the proclamation. So the Herald Leader's Twitter account quoted Speaker Osborne as sympathizing with the Democrats, but saying that his hands are basically tied by the narrowness of the proclamation. So just to be clear here, the House did not vote on these. The chair ruled the amendments out of order. saying that that's Jasmine, going back to your original question about who makes the decisions, the Speaker made the decision that the amendments were out of order with respect to the proclamation.
Okay. So I guess you can file whatever you want, but mm-hmm. then they can say no.
No, that's incorrect. Yeah. You can't do that. Yeah. You're not allowed to do that. Yeah. So the bill itself, HB 1, passed the House on a 52-46 vote. Pretty close. It needed 51 votes to pass. It cleared it by one. I guess two. So the GOP members who actually voted no on this bill included Travis Brenda, Deanna Fraser, Robert Goforth, Jeff Hoover, Regina Huff, Scott Lewis, Bobby McCool, Jim Stewart, and Tommy Turner. Tommy Turner also voted against it in committee. So there you go. It did pass the House. That was the dramatic part. And as expected, when the bill moved to the Senate on Tuesday, things were much less dramatic. So the Democratic bills obviously didn't pass the House. They were not passed out of committee. So the only vote for the Senate to take was on HB 1. And in committee in the Senate, HB 1 passed along party lines. The Democrats sent three amendments to the floor the next day when the bill made it to the floor of the Senate, and that was Wednesday, July 24th, but they were voted down. Interestingly, the Senate actually voted on these amendments. They didn't just rule them out of order. It makes you think that the Senate was like, oh yeah, come at us. We have a billion people here. You've got like nine.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it happened in the Senate. And the bill itself passed the Senate on a 27-11 vote with two Republicans crossing party lines. That's Tom Buford and C.B. Embry. So with that, the special session ended on Wednesday, and Governor Bevin signed the bill into law. And Jasmine, at the end of the day, the session, you know, this wasn't very dramatic. Although getting to the point where the legislature could actually be called into session was pretty tough for the governor. I think we've talked about it ad nauseum, like getting the votes they needed. At the end of the day, Governor Bevin's preferred bill passed without any changes to the language by the GOP in either chamber. So
right, which is pretty simple when you have such a large majority. But like we have talked about many times, I believe that some think that this required 60 votes,
mm-hmm.
and so we'll probably see litigation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we certainly will. And because it's non-severable, it could spell trouble for the quasis down the road. And, you know, the reaction in the days since has been very negative for Democrats, as is expected, but I think it's kind of interesting how the Democrats are, like, warning that this could be a precursor to what could happen to everybody. Everybody essentially will have to move to 401ks who work for the quasis, or 401bs, I don't remember the numbers, those private accounts from a pension. That's kind of what they're moving everybody to who works for a quasi. And I think Democrats are saying, you know, that's likely what's going to happen to all public workers if we continue down this path. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll see. They go into regular session again, you know, at the beginning of next year. So there might be a new governor by then, though. Okay, Jasmine, tell us what we need to know about a new Senate candidate.
All right. We have a second Democratic challenger in the 2020 Senate race against Mitch McConnell. His name is Mike Breuer. He is a retired Marine. He's a lieutenant colonel, just like Amy McGrath. And he's also a farmer, educator, and he was a newspaper editor for a time as well. He's actually from Wisconsin, but he moved to Kentucky in 2005. He lives on a farm in Lincoln County. That's in central Kentucky. It's about like an hour south of Lexington. And in addition to farming, he's also a substitute teacher for Lincoln County schools.
Nice.
Kind of similar to Amy McGrath's background, like he hasn't always been in Kentucky. He's also a Marine, but I think he's a little bit critical of Amy McGrath,
right?
Just by looking at his website.
I mean, he's running against her, so that makes sense.
He describes his campaign as economic and social justice for all, and he's using the hashtag strip the label. And his website says that he's running a people-powered campaign to bring Kentuckians from all walks of life together to strip away the labels that Mitch McConnell uses to reinforce old prejudices, diminish, and divide us. But he actually released a really well-done video mm-hmm. the day that he launched his campaign that, on its face, I think looks like maybe a more progressive campaign than the one that Amy McGrath seems to be running. But there's also kind of a sneaky Ronald Reagan quote on his website. So I don't know, maybe hard to tell. You know, I think some of his priorities seem kind of moderate. He advocates for raising the minimum wage to $10 an hour, but not necessarily to $15, federalizing student loans, but not necessarily any advocacy for canceling any student debt or anything like that. And he also has a portion of his website where he says he supports the Second Amendment, but he does advocate for some common sense regulation. And one thing to note that I saw, that he does say he wants to legalize marijuana, and it does not just say medicinal. Mm-hmm. So I think he supports recreational marijuana as well, or that's what it seems like
right.
from his website anyways. But it also includes a dig at Amy McGrath. He said, Mike is the only Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate who has publicly stated that he will vote against confirming any judicial nominee who refuses to publicly acknowledge that Roe v. Wade is settled law and it was decided correctly. So
yeah.
I think that was in response to Amy McGrath's comments about Brett Kavanaugh. And he gave an interview to the Courier Journal, and he said about that, the Kavanaugh thing was inexplicable to me. She found Christine Blasey Ford to be a credible witness, but yeah, she would have voted for Kavanaugh. That was troubling. At the core of what troubles me is I don't recognize her from the candidate she was just a year ago.
Yeah, Jasmine, we talked a little bit about Amy McGrath and how, you know, there's benefits to going first because you get to put your message out in front of everybody and, you know, you get to raise money off of being first. There's also mm-hmm. some advantages to going second because you can look at the mistakes the person that went yeah. first went and do stuff like this, right? Yeah.
Right. And don't worry, he has already admitted that he voted for Hillary Clinton. So I do not think we'll have the Allison Lundergan Grimes who did they vote for issue. He told the Courier Journal that he did vote for Hillary Clinton. He was also asked who he likes for the 2020 presidential election, and he said that he likes Mayor Pete, Elizabeth Warren, and that Kamala Harris is also an interesting choice. So that's a little bit about our new Senate candidate, Mike Breuer.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, the sharpness of his video, and I think that was very apparent. You know, whenever you hear about somebody getting into this race, you always kind of got to worry that maybe it's like a gadfly, maybe like a Jeff Young type candidate or something like that. But he seems very serious.
Yeah, I think so too.
His campaign, or the consultant that's working on his campaign is Kim Gevedin, who's been pretty successful in Kentucky. Will Kersey, who's no longer in the legislature, but who actually won his seat in 2016 when the Trump year and everything. He ran his campaign and won in 2016. He's also helped Chris Harris some mm-hmm. who runs in a pretty tough district there in Martin County and Pike County, which is, you know, of course, Martin County is very, very Republican. And that part of Pike County is pretty Democratic. But Chris Harris always wins with pretty big margins. Will Kersey won really big in 2016 and then left to run for judge executive. And I think Marshall County is where he was. And I think he actually lost that race. And Chris Freeland, who ran for that seat in the open seat as a Republican, won huge when it wasn't Will Kersey running. So Kim Gevedin has won in districts that are tough in Kentucky. And so he knows what he's doing a little bit. And I think that this will be a good challenge for Amy McGrath.
Yeah, I think when people heard the name, he seems like an unknown to everyone.
I mean, he is an unknown.
Yeah, he's
no
the first time candidate. But I think it happened at the perfect time.
Yeah.
It was, you know, just a few days after. There was a lot of frustration from Democrats about the whole Amy McGrath rollout from beginning to the Kavanaugh comments.
Right.
And so I think that this came at a perfect time, and it was a very like professional video and a good website. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, I think it could be an interesting primary.
Yeah. In the middle of the race, I've heard Amy McGrath has raised like up to $4 million now. That's just in media reports. There's no like actual reporting of that. That's going to be a tough thing to overcome for whoever wants to run against her.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's good for her to have a foil, somebody who can like run against her. And I already think I'm starting to see some changes from Amy McGrath's campaign since she kind of went to ground. I think she's starting to talk a little bit more. And I'm starting to, I don't know, I think she's kind of responded in a way that I find a little hopeful, but we'll see. She has a long way to go, and obviously there's a lot of time left before the election. So we'll see how everything shakes out, but it's nice, I think, that she has an opponent.
Yeah, and still more time for more opponents.
And too. I think that likely will happen. Okay, Jasmine, the other thing we wanted to talk about today is that there is a new caucus in the House. So a diverse group of Democratic legislators from across Kentucky announced the beginning of a new caucus during the special session, and it is called the Commonwealth Caucus. So the caucus is formed by an interesting group. So Sherrilyn Stevenson, Representative Sherrilyn Stevenson, is the founder. I think she's the one that helped started to organize it. Representative Charles Booker, Representative Chris Harris, Angie Hatton, Kathy Hinckley, Maria Sorolis, and Rob Wiederstein which it could be Wiederstein. I should go back and listen to the show we did with him from Henderson, are the people who founded the Commonwealth Caucus. So the slogan of the group is finding common ground for the common good. So they had a press conference where they announced their formation, and there were a lot of people that were covering this creation. And in a tweet from the introductory press conference, Herald Leader journalist Daniel DeRochers said that the caucus wanted to, quote, refocus the political conversation to the middle, unquote. So with that quote about the middle, Sherrilyn Stevenson pushed back against that. She said that the point of the caucus was not about the middle, but about putting everyday Kentuckians first. So Jasmine, there's a lot of observers who are used to politicians using language like this around like finding common ground, et cetera, and see that as like an advocate for centrism, like going to the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Stevenson and the rest of the caucus seem to be explicitly attempting to reject centrism as an organizing principle of the caucus. You know, the caucus does include centrists. I don't think anybody's going to say like Chris Harris or Rob Wiederstein or you know, even Kathy Hinkley or Maria Sorales are like, you know, raging leftists or anything. So they do include some centrists. But I think that the organizing principle for the Commonwealth Caucus seems to be around finding common ground, which does not necessarily imply centrism, at least in my opinion. And I think that the success of this caucus depends on the ability of the group to make the case that finding common ground does not necessarily include centrism. You know, and from their announcement document, I think there's more evidence of this. It says, quote, it's critical to emphasize issues, not political parties or divisive, cynical political games to distract and divide Kentuckians instead of working to find ways we can work together to build a stronger, prosperous Kentucky that doesn't leave anyone or any region behind, unquote. So, you know, that's a really key thing for the Democratic Party to be able to do. The Democratic Party has gotten a lot more diverse ideologically. You have people who are truly liberal in the Democratic caucus. There's more of them now. There used to be like two or three from Louisville. Now there's more. There's like 10 or 12 from Louisville that are really liberal. And then, of course, those people from out in the state, you know, they remain pretty centrist, maybe people from the suburbs of Louisville that are pretty centrist as well. And getting all these people on the same page and finding ways to work together is really key, in my opinion. So geographically, Booker and Sorolis, of course, are from Louisville. Harris, Hinckley, and Hatton are from Eastern Kentucky. And Rob Wiederstein is from, you know, Western Kentucky, I guess, Henderson, wherever you put Henderson. Do you say Henderson's Western Kentucky?
Western-ish. Yeah.
I put it in quotes in the notes. So, yeah, that's where he's from. And although they are from across the state, one of the things they do all have in common is they're generally pretty new to the legislature. So Booker, Stevenson, Sorolis, Wiederstein, and Hinckley are all freshmen. So they're all in their first term. And Hatton is in her second term, and Harris, Chris Harris, is the old hat. He's the one that's in his third term. So that's all of them. There's nobody that's been in the legislature more than 5 years at this point. So they make reference to their junior status in their announcement document. They say, quote, we're going to start doing something about it while we're still crazy enough to think that our job is to represent all Kentuckians, unquote.
I like that.
Yeah, I do too. And just in case you think that this is all like wishy-washy and just like finding common ground when you actually don't find any common ground and just talk about it, they did also release a policy platform. And the tenets that they introduced in their policy platform were family-supporting jobs, economic development, a healthy Kentucky, quality public education and job training, rebuilding our infrastructure, and strengthening our democracy. So, Jasmine, I think if Democrats in the House want to grow their caucus, if they want to get more members, if they want to get more Democrats elected to the House, they're going to need to become more ideologically diverse. They're going to have to win some of these more conservative regions, and also they're going to have to really solidify these more liberal regions. And that means they're going to have to get more ideologically diverse. However, you know, that often leads to division and dissension. And, you know, if you've been paying attention to national politics at all in the past couple of months, the Democratic Party in the you know, federal House of Representatives has been very divided over ideology. It seems to me that this group is building a caucus that at its core is about finding the democratic principles that unite the caucus and move it forward. So I think that this is a great idea, and I hope that there's more people that join in.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep. They also said they're going to have town halls across Kentucky, so stay tuned for that, I guess.
Cool.
Okay, Jasmine, before we get out of here, we have some quick hits. So, Jasmine, the special session has been big news, of course, but apparently it has not been big enough to keep Governor Bevin in the state. He was actually photographed in Colorado on Tuesday listening to Vice President Mike Pence. So,
didn't he also post a picture with the president this week, too?
Yeah, I don't know if that was old or new or whatever. But he was photographed by a third party with Mike Pence in Colorado, not Kentucky, during the special session. So just a fun fact while we're here, but prior to 1992, the lieutenant governor actually became the acting governor whenever the governor left the state, which always led to like some interesting things. So there was a lieutenant governor back in the 70s named Thelma Stovall, and she actually called a special session that passed two bills while Julian Carroll was like on vacation or something. So, you know, she changed the tax laws like while he was gone. And while he was out of state also, she vetoed the legislature's attempt to de-ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Kentucky ratified the Equal Rights Amendment a while back, and they tried to undo that, and Thelma Stovall, as the acting governor, vetoed it. So that was cool.
Bold moves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, you know, because of all the stuff that's been going on with Governor Bevin and his lieutenant governor, Jeanine Hampton, can you imagine if that was like still the rule? Like if he'd gone to Colorado to hear Mike Pence talk like in the middle of the special session, she could have just been like...
She could like reappoint her...
She could do that. She could also
and
she could have changed the proclamation to make everything severable. She could have just been like, no, we're not doing this anymore. And he could have come back into session. There's any number of things that could have happened. Unfortunately, though, that 1992 amendment changed everything for the lieutenant governor. And now they basically don't do anything.
Did Thelma ruin it for everybody else?
Maybe. That was a while after that they changed it. Okay, Jasmine, next quick hit is that Rand Paul was one of two senators to vote against the 9/11 Victims Fund bill in the United States Senate. He blamed the debt and the deficit as his reason for voting against this. But just as a reminder, Rand Paul voted for the Trump tax cut last year, or I guess 2 years ago at this point, which increased the debt by $1.5 trillion.
So, seems a little inconsistent.
Well, he says spending is out of control. I think if we were to ask him, he'd be like, I don't care about taxes. I want less taxes. I want less spending. And yeah. I guess he just doesn't think first responders are worth it. So there you go. That's Rand Paul for you. Okay. Representative Diane St. Onge of Northern Kentucky has resigned her seat to move to California with her husband, who she recently married. That means we're going to have a special session. This is kind of an interesting district. It's in Northern Kentucky. This is suburbs of Cincinnati. It goes all the way to the river, like on the Covington side. You know, this was not a blowout. I think it was within 10 points, maybe a little bit more than 10 points last time, with Diane St. Onge being somebody who was a pretty known quantity up there. We'll see. I mean, it could be interesting whenever this does happen, whenever the special session happens later on this year. So
Special election.
What did I say?
Special session.
Well, we'll leave that part in because people need to know that I mess up sometimes.
That's what you said.
Yeah. Okay. And lastly, as we talk about every week, where was Andy Beshear this week? According to his Twitter, he did events in both Oldham County and Wolf County since our last episode. So one of my favorite quotes was Ben Chandler once when he went to Wolf County. I don't know why I was there. And I especially don't know why I was seeing Ben Chandler when he was running for governor. But he said, "Hooray, Wolf County." And I just always remember that because he had such a unique voice.
Hooray.
Yeah, he lost that election to Ernie Fletcher. So anyways. All right, Jasmine. I think we're going to get out of here in less than half an hour. So how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at MyOldKYPod. They can like our Facebook page and listen to our podcast on the podcasting app of their choice. We also have a newsletter that comes out on Friday mornings, and you can subscribe to that and Ford Kentucky's other newsletters at fordky.com/email. And finally, we have a Patreon where you can sponsor what we do for as little as a dollar a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.